Today is Thursday, May 17th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the fate of a summit between President Trump and North Korea's leader remains unclear.
We'll see what happens. We'll see. Time will tell.
Turmoil in Venezuela as the country's threatened with sanctions. The immigration debate heats up again in Washington. Also ahead, a Ghanaian immigrant who lost his life saving others is being hailed for his heroism. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, North Korea Wednesday threatened to scrap a historic summit next month between its leader Kim Jong-un and U.S. President Donald Trump, saying it has no interest in a one-sided affair meant to pressure the North to abandon its nuclear weapons. Pyongyang's warning came hours after the country abruptly canceled a high-level meeting with South Korea Wednesday to protest U.S.-South Korean military exercises that the North has long claimed are an invasion rehearsal. So the surprise move appears to cool what had been an unusual flurry of outreach from a country that last year conducted a provocative series of banned weapons tests that had many fearing the region was on the edge of war. President Trump Wednesday said Washington would insist North Korea give up its nuclear weapons. And White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders said the Trump administration is still hopeful that a planned summit with North Korea will take place.
This is something that we fully expected. The president is very used and ready for tough negotiations. And if they want to meet, we'll be ready. And if they don't, that's okay, too. We'll continue with the campaign of maximum pressure if that's the case. But like I just said, if they want to meet, the president will certainly be ready. And we will be prepared. But if not, that's okay.
Joining us now from Seoul, South Korea, is reporter Amy Gutman. Amy, you are in Seoul at an Asian leadership conference. What's the talk there about this developing situation?
Well, what's interesting is that this conference usually has a little bit of the programming devoted each year to regional politics and stability. But this year, we've seen the whole thing kind of turn upside down. And obviously, organizers were scrambling at the last minute with all the news of this impending meeting with Trump. So that essentially 50% of the conference, I'd say, has been devoted to this. So we've seen experts from the top think tanks around the world, Korea specialists, all weighing in on their reaction, plans for the future, speculation. I have to say almost every panel has begun with, okay, here are the three or four different scenarios that could happen. this is the rating we give each, you know, in terms of what's most likely to occur. The biggest conversation here has focused on what's seen as the about face from North Korea on the upcoming meeting with Trump, and the sense that the typical traditional behavior that we've become accustomed to from North Korea, that is flipping back and forth between agreeing to meet, not agreeing to meet, what's on the table, what's not on the table, is back in play. And so, in a sense, people are saying that there's almost a sense of relief because there had been almost a disbelief that they could feel so much optimism and that a meeting could happen so easily.
And that Kim Jong-un would be so agreeable to just give up nukes and like that?
Exactly. So in a sense, people are saying, okay, we're almost relieved because this is the North Korean regime that we've come to know and expect. And so without this, we would be even more suspicious almost, which is kind of a catch-22.
Right.
But others have made a really critical, important point. You can't overlook America's role in this recent turn of events. So preceding this turn of events, we heard Secretary of State Mike Pompeo come out suggesting that American capital and investment and raw materials could be sent to North Korea once a deal was struck to help rebuild infrastructure in the country. You can imagine how well this went over. North Korea, it's been suggested, and I think it's very reasonable to understand, will have been deeply offended by this, as would any country. We saw this in Cuba a couple of years ago when we were, you know, on the cusp of rapprochement there too. We heard talks about all the American investment that would come, and Cuban government leadership said, look, we don't want the same Cuba as before. We don't want McDonald's on our streets. This isn't about American investment. This isn't about a great play for American commercial interests. Don't make it about that. So in some respects, I don't think this response is so unreasonable, and I think it's really important to think about this context. This isn't necessarily simply flip-flopping. This is a sincere and genuine and fairly valid response to comments that can understandably be seen as offensive. So some are saying this was a rookie diplomat's mistake. Why would you ever come out and say something like this, especially in these very delicate days leading up to this meeting? The other interesting point is that when we think of this delicate period leading up to this important meeting, people are saying that one of the important things that we're noticing here is that there's a lot of emphasis on the peace agreement and less focus on the denuclearization agreement. And there is some concern here that too much emphasis is being placed on the peace agreement and not enough in balance with the denuclearization agreement. And there's a worry that Kim Jong-un could see this as strictly a peace agreement and that the denuclearization part, which of course is so crucial to the U.S. and the rest of the world, will not bear as much weight and will be negotiated too heavily.
This is all assuming that this even happens. We know he's threatening for it not to happen. What is the sense that you're getting there? Do people, for the most part, think that this actually will happen and this is just posturing?
People feel, by and large, that there will be posturing from both sides. These are two very decisive leaders. Neither of them have small egos. So the sense is that there will be posturing from both sides. Both sides may threaten to cancel between now and June 12th, but that ultimately there's too much in this for Kim Jong-un not to show up. Simply by turning up, he already creates a softer perception of him. And this is a man who's been educated in the West, younger than his predecessors were when they took on this role. And so he's aware of how much perception of him and his country matters. So the feeling is that he will turn up because there's too much in it for him not to.
And do they feel that it will actually accomplish anything significant and substantial?
The key concern is about maintaining the denuclearization process alongside the peace process. So people are concerned that there's too much emphasis on peace and not enough emphasis and pressure being applied to denuclearization. There's a concern that leaders need to keep up this pressure. On the other hand, it's a balancing act. Keep up the pressure, but not so much pressure that he cancels the meeting. There's a sense here that North Korea will certainly not agree to disarm entirely, and that is very hard to imagine. But many believe that a gradual denuclearization could work, and certainly that would be very agreeable to South Korea.
All right. We appreciate your perspective. Reporter Amy Gutman in Seoul, South Korea. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Bomb blasts are heard in Gaza in the early hours of Wednesday. A U.S. court sentences a Turkish banker in Iran's sanctions case. The U.S. Senate votes to restore net neutrality. And Kenya approves a controversial cyber crimes law. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump is hammering California for its sanctuary policies. Trump on Wednesday met with local California leaders who oppose the state's refusal to cooperate with federal immigration authorities. That includes failing to notify federal officials when people living in the country illegally are released from jails.
The law that forces the release of illegal immigrant criminals, drug dealers, gang members, and violent predators into your communities. California's law provide safe harbor to some of the most vicious and violent offenders on earth.
Trump argues that the policies violate federal law and result in the release of criminals into communities.
We cannot let this butchery happen in America. The state of California's attempts to nullify federal law have sparked a rebellion by patriotic citizens who want their families protected and their borders secured. They want border security. They want protection. That's what we're all about. We're about protection, both from international and from, frankly, people crossing a border illegally.
Well, California Governor Jerry Brown last year signed a law that bars people or police from asking people about their immigration status or helping federal agents with immigration enforcement. He insists the legislation doesn't prevent federal immigration officials from doing their jobs. And he responded to President Trump's comments on Twitter, writing Trump is, quote, lying on immigration, lying about crime, and lying about the laws of California. Meanwhile, on Maryland's eastern shore on the east coast of the United States, crab houses have hired temporary foreign workers, mostly from Mexico, since the 1980s to extract meat from the crab's hard shells. The visas let the workers live and work in the U.S. during the warmer months and then return to their home country in the winter. This year, the Trump administration's decision to tighten restrictions in the H-2B visa program has left crab house owners in dire circumstances. VOA immigration correspondent Alini Barros traveled to Hooper's Island to talk to them.
Olivia Rubio does the hard, tedious work of extracting crab meat. She has been coming to Hooper's Island for 15 years from Mexico to work in one of Maryland's Eastern Shore crab houses on an H-2B visa.
We have the opportunity to come here to work and support our family, help our children move forward, and support our parents. It's good. We have work, so we're grateful.
H-2B visa holders live and work in the United States during the spring, summer, and fall, and then they return home in the winter. The temporary worker program has been used by crab houses since the 1980s to make up for the lack of local workers.
I don't know what we would do or the whole area would do without them. I mean, from the stores to, I don't even know how to describe it because of the impact that they have. They keep it all moving.
This year, there's a shortage of crab pickers. G.W. Hall & Son needed 40 guest work visas, but only got 30. At nearby Russell Hall Seafood, baskets and crates, empty. The kitchen, unused. No workers in sight.
It never was this way before. We've done this for 25 years. And no doubt some years it's been slow getting our workers, but we've always gotten them.
Citing higher demand for guest worker visas, the Trump administration this year awarded them through a lottery instead of first come, first served. Phillips Company needed 50 visas but got none.
That's a big gamble. I mean, we can't run our business at a gamble whether we're going to get our workers or not.
Maryland has 20 licensed crab businesses, employing 500 foreign workers. A.E. Phillips & Son is also shut down unless more workers become available.
Because I've got workers that come from both sides in central Mexico.
General Manager Morgan Tolley says he's really worried about 2019.
We have some problems going on with immigration. A lot of issues are up in the air. A lot of things people don't understand or they think they understand. Speaking for the H-2B program, which is a non-immigrant work visa, to me personally, that has nothing to do with immigration. It's a non-immigrant work visa. These people take tremendous pride in the fact that they can come here to the United States and work and go home. And they're proud of that right that they have earned.
Maryland crab season is underway. The harvest is good. But as the crabs roll in, will there be anybody to process them? Alini Barros, VOA News, Hooper's Island, Maryland.
Well, a couple of hundred people came out in protest Wednesday in Caracas, Venezuela, as President Nicolas Maduro dismissed the threat of new sanctions following an early election called for Sunday. It's an election which critics have denounced as a sham aimed at tightening his grip on power. VOA's Victor Beatty talks about it with Jeff Ramsey, a Venezuela analyst with the Washington Office of Latin America.
I think it's very clear that these elections lack strong electoral guarantees. And because of that, you know, Maduro is expected to win. But it's also true that because of widespread abstention, Maduro probably won't have to carry out fraud to win anyway.
The opposition, of course, is boycotting. Is the key turnout?
I do think if enough opposition voters were to turn out, it would make the government's job in terms of carrying out fraud much more difficult. I mean, they would have to do it on a scale that we haven't really seen so far. I mean, polls do suggest that opposition candidate Henry Falcón has about a 10-point lead over Maduro. However, having said that, because of abstention and because of preferences of likely voters, the two are currently tied among likely voters.
Mr. Maduro had an interview with France 24 television. He described Venezuela as a democratic country and really said it was an example for other nations. Is he living in an unreal world?
I think it's pretty clear now that Venezuela is certainly something other than an electoral democracy. I think over the last year and a half, we've witnessed the country go into what can best be characterized as an authoritarian slide. You know, and I really think that these elections, which are being held in conditions in which the main opposition parties were disqualified, their leaders banned from holding political office, I think it's pretty safe to say that these are not free and fair elections.
Several hundred demonstrators, called opposition demonstrators, blocked traffic in a march in Caracas to the building of the Organization of American States. But long gone, apparently, are the months of mass protests that drew hundreds of thousands onto the streets. What's happened?
I mean, I think ultimately there is a sense among Venezuelans that there's sort of a mass apathy. I mean, there's no real alternative being proposed by the traditional opposition. You know, there's not a lot of faith that these elections will bring any change. And ultimately, the mass protests that happened last year were met with brutal repression. Over 100 people were killed, and they resulted in no change either. So I think ultimately Venezuelans are, in general, left with sort of this lack of a clear path forward, and it's why so many are fleeing the country.
Describe the economic conditions of the country. Inflation, of course, is hovering close to 14,000%.
You know, it's true. The country is in the midst of its worst economic crisis. There's hyperinflation, there's mass scarcity of basic food and medication, and people are dying of treatable diseases. I mean, if you suffer from hypertension or are HIV positive or even cut yourself and that cut gets affected, I mean, these are now life-threatening conditions in Venezuela, where in most of the world, they're quite treatable.
Why is this election being called early?
Well, ultimately, it's because Maduro understands that he has the opposition exactly where he wants them. I mean, they are deeply divided between the abstentionist faction that does not believe in any kind of participation in elections, and those who still think that even though the deck is stacked against them, it's worth it to participate in elections.
Jeff, the European Union and the U.S. are threatening more sanctions, the U.S. possibly imposing oil sanctions. What might that do to Venezuela, and is the country effectively isolated?
I think it's pretty likely that we'll see some kind of escalation of sanctions. I think the EU will probably continue adding names to its list of Venezuelan officials on the targeted sanctions list. We may see some countries in Latin America adopt targeted sanctions. And there is this threat of an oil embargo from the United States. Ultimately, you know, we think that would be a humanitarian disaster. You know, at a time when the country is undergoing hyperinflation and there's mass scarcity of basic goods, you'd essentially be impacting the only semi-functional thing that's still working in Venezuela's economy. And that's obviously fallen, and the state oil company is rife with corruption. But ultimately, the revenue that Venezuela generates from its oil sector still accounts for about 90% of its resources to pay for things like imports of food and medicine. So this threat of an oil embargo or even sanctions against elements of the oil sector would be an outright disaster.
That's Jeff Ramsey. He monitors events in Venezuela at the Washington office of Latin America. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Thank you.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, a new fissure has opened on Hawaii's Big Island as its Kilauea volcano continues to erupt. U.S. Geological Survey officials are warning the new volcano has entered a phase of more continuous and explosive activity. Rock falls and gas explosions from the crater have created clouds of ash, which can irritate the eyes and respiratory system. The new fissure brings the total number of lava and gas spewing cracks to 20 since the May 3rd eruption. VOA's Latika Hulk reports.
A series of lava sprays illuminated the night on Hawaii's Big Island after yet another crack opened in the ground. The new eruptions launched molten rocks into the air.
I've actually seen rocks fly over the tree line, and I can feel in my body.
A plume of ash billowed over the volcano on Tuesday, spreading sulfur dioxide in the air. Officials rated the air quality in the area as a condition red, which means the air could pose an immediate danger, especially for the elderly, people with respiratory problems, and children. Fissures running through a residential area have damaged homes and forced evacuations. Officials can't say when the next eruption is coming or when the volcanic activity will stop.
At this time, it's about 2 miles away from Highway 137 and is traveling at 100 yards per hour. That measurement was taken this morning, so it could have gone faster, could have slowed down.
Curing federal money to help pay for the ongoing emergency response here in Hawaii, including the possibility of more evacuation.
We wanted to definitely thank the governor, Ige, for giving us an opportunity to write a letter to President Trump to be able to have an emergency declaration. I mean, what happened this past only in one day, he was able to get this emergency declaration. So definitely, that definitely helps the Hawaii County. But basically, it's a team effort. It's a team effort of county, state, working with the federal government and also the National Guard to be able to coordinate this effort in regards to what's happening in Leilani Estates.
Local officials say only a portion of the island has been affected.
It's a very small area in Leilani Estates. It involves all the way from Kalapana all the way to Pohiki, but it does not involve the total island. It's a portion of the island.
The Hawaiian islands, including the one called the Big Island, depend on tourism, and businesses are eager to convince visitors that most of the island is safe and open for business. But tourism officials say the bookings for hotels and tours are down by about 50%, and some cruise ships have canceled their stops at the island. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
Well, a deadly apartment fire in New York City claimed 13 lives at the end of last year, but the death toll could have been higher were it not for the heroic actions of a 26-year-old Ghanaian immigrant who lost his life while saving others. VOA's Salem Solomon reports from New York.
It was the deadliest fire in 27 years. 13 people were killed, including a 7-month-old baby. But as the mourning continues for the lives lost last December, New York officials have hailed the actions of a Ghanaian immigrant who died saving lives. Private first class in the U.S. National Guard, Emmanuel Mensa, lived on the third floor of the Bronx building, which caught fire when a 3-year-old played with the knobs of a stove. After making sure the people he lived with escaped, Mensa returned again and again to the burning building, bringing out 4 people. He was later discovered on the 4th floor, having died from smoke inhalation.
If I'm here and I see, let's say, fire, I'll be running like hell. You know, I'll be running away, and the people were running away. But for him to have that courage and get people out, comes first, went back again the fire, and then went back again, back and forth. Then you can pinpoint how kind of, that kind of nature he is. I don't have to say all this and say, "Whoa, my son is good." You can say that. You can say it for yourself.
Mensa, a newly naturalized American citizen, immigrated to the U.S. to live with his father. His mother had died in childbirth in Accra, Ghana. He had an interest in engineering and computers, but he found meaning in helping others and had dreams of becoming a police officer. In 2016, he joined the National Guard. Staff Sergeant Ruben Martinez Ortiz was Mensa's recruiting officer.
He was definitely what any, I would want to serve with somebody like Emmanuel Mensa, you know? there's people that join the military for, you know, for whatever reasons and stuff like that, but then you know who you'd want to serve next to. And he was definitely one person that I would have wanted to serve next to. He was a soldier's soldier.
Mensah touched many lives, including Margot Perkins, a neighbor who lives adjacent to the building that caught fire.
You know, when I think about him, I talk to him in my mind, because I feel like he's still around. He used to call me Mom. Whenever I needed something done, he always did it. He's a good angel.
Mensah's father hopes his son isn't forgotten. To be known for acts of selflessness and bravery, he said, is the hallmark of a life with meaning.
His legacy is something that I cherish a lot. That makes me feel he came to this world to do what he did. Once and for all, he did what he was supposed to do, and he's out of this world. And sooner or later, I will be well before long. But he has to be remembered as a hero.
Mensah had planned to continue his training and join the military police. He became a U.S. citizen in September, and although his life was lost, he would live on. This year, New York will officially rename the street corner where the fire took place after him. From Woodland Cemetery in the Bronx, Salem Solomon, VOA News, New York.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Glenn Hollis. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month, Israel celebrated its 70th anniversary of independence. Speaking on the occasion, Vice President Mike Pence said, "We gather here to celebrate nothing less than a miracle of history, the day when the Jewish people ended the longest exile of any people anywhere and reclaimed a Jewish future and rebuilt the Jewish state." The United States of America, said Vice President Pence, was proud to be the first nation in the world to recognize the State of Israel 7 decades ago. And just as President Harry Truman made history then, President Donald Trump made history now, almost exactly 70 years to the minute from the rebirth of the Jewish state, the American embassy officially opened in Jerusalem, the capital of the State of Israel. By finally recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the United States has chosen fact over fiction. And fact is the only true foundation for a just and lasting peace, said Vice President Pence. The United States believes peace is possible between the Palestinians and Israelis. And while any peace will undoubtedly require compromise, Mr. Pence reiterated that the United States will never compromise the safety and security of the State of Israel. The United States and Israel will continue to confront the evil scourge of radical Islamic terrorism. That's why the United States is leading the free world in standing up to Iran, the leading state sponsor of terror, by withdrawing America from the Iran nuclear deal. The United States, stressed Mr. Pence, will never allow Iran to obtain a nuclear weapon. In 70 short years, Israel has become one of the freest, strongest, and most prosperous nations on earth. As Vice President Pence said, "We stand with Israel because her cause is our cause, her values our values, and her fight is our fight. We stand with Israel because we believe in right over wrong and good over evil and liberty over tyranny." With the support of the United States and with God's help, said Vice President Pence, "I know Israel will go from strength to strength. Her first 70 years will just be a glimpse of what's to come. And the United States and Israel will meet our glorious future together."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.